are at time. This is the Wolf Committee of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we have one stated agenda item today, which we will get to. Our second agenda item is just anything that is of importance that's come up, sort of a reporting agenda item. So we will get right to the stated agenda item, which is an update on the population wolf, Washington wolf population modeling. We have representatives from the University of Washington who are carrying out this scientific endeavor for us. And they've been really gracious with the Wolf Committee. We've had one previous presentation, and they committed to sort of keeping us abreast as this research continues. And so we're back for our second presentation. And I to Sarah Converse.
Hi, nice to see you all. Maybe we'll just do quick introductions of our team and finish it off with Lisa Ann, and she can go ahead and do the presentation. Is that how you want to do it, Kim?
Perfect.
Perfect. Okay, great. I know many of you. I'm Sarah Converse. I'm the leader of the Washington Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit at the University of Washington and a faculty member at University of Washington, and I work closely with DFW on a variety of projects in my role as the leader of the co-op unit and a PI on the project that we brought Lisa Ann onto to work on the wolf population model. My expertise and my research is in quantitative population ecology and the use of population models and management. I think I'll send it over to Beth next.
Hi, everyone. I'm Beth Gardner. I'm an associate professor in the School of Environmental and Forest Sciences at University of Washington. And much like Sarah, my research interests are mostly in statistical ecology, population modeling. And I'm also working on part of the Predator-Prey Project, which you might be familiar with in the state of Washington, as well as with the work here with Sarah and Lisa Ann.
Great. Thanks, Beth. You know, before Lisa Ann takes over, we don't usually have Ben at our meeting, and I know he's working closely with you. So, Ben, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and talk about how you're interacting with the project. And then, Lisa Ann, since you're going to be doing the presentation, you can do the last introduction and then start the presentation. Ben?
Yeah, I'm Ben Maletsky. I'm the statewide wolf specialist for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm based out of Cle Elum, but obviously work statewide doing the monitoring work and, you know, trying to get assess recovery on the ground, what's happening on the ground, and been trying to convey that information to Lizanne and Sarah and Beth so they can do all this modeling and trying to get them all that data. They've been doing a great job pulling all that together. So
I just want to say Ben has been awesome to work with. I know he's got about a zillion things going on, and he's been really, really quick to respond and helping us make sense of all of the data and the information. So thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Sarah. And thank you, Ben, for joining us today. Lisa Ann, I think it's yours.
All right, cool. Well, I guess before I start the presentation, I'll reintroduce myself. So yeah, my name's Lisa Ann. I am a postdoc at UW. I started June 1st. My specialties, my dog just ran into the wall. That was that noise you just heard. My specialty, I guess, is modeling, space use of large carnivores. My background, I have about a decade's worth of experience working in big cat conservation, working for the nonprofit Panthera. So I've done a lot of work with jaguars, African lions in particular. Now here I am in the wolf world. So I'm really happy to be here and happy to show you all what we've been up to. So let me share my screen here. Let me get this ready. Notes are going over here. So hopefully this will work. You should be seeing a big old slide with the title on it. So
there we go.
It looks good.
All right, we're ready to go. The presentation goes for about 17 minutes or so. So figured that was a good enough time to fill you in without putting you all to sleep. So we'll also take your questions after. So here we go. So again, we're here to update you all on that modeling tool for wolf status review in Washington State. And so this process has been going on now for about 6 months. So again, our goal is to use rigorous quantitative science to assess progress towards wolf recovery goals in Washington. And thus far, I think we are upholding that goal. So we'll see where we're at. A reminder of who we are. Well, I guess I can skip this slide because we've already done introductions. But I do want to add to what Sarah had said. We so appreciate the work of Ben and his team in getting us the data and helping us understand it. Again, I'm primarily a big cat ecologist. I've never worked with wolves before. And so having Ben able to fill us in on what he's seeing has been so invaluable to us. And also he's just really quick in responding, which is kind of rare these days. So thank you, Ben. So what do we hope to achieve here? So again, estimating these demographic rates for wolves in Washington. And by demographic rates, I mean survival, I mean recruitment and dispersal. Again, that spatial process is so important here for a colonizing population. Also connecting these demographic rates, which are largely at the individual level, to a spatial pack level colonization process. Again, like the survival, recruitment, those can be done non-spatially. In a modeling framework, but the spatial aspect here is what's so critical, which is why we're connecting that individual model to that pack level process. We will be developing simulation scenarios to account for different wolf management strategies, and that is a work in progress, and as well to use both our current conditions and simulated scenarios to assess progress toward our recovery goals. So a reminder of recovery goals. I'm sure you all have this memorized, but in case you need a refresher. So for the wolf to be delisted in the state, so it's all about breeding pairs, the numbers and where they are. So we need 4 breeding pairs in each recovery region, and then 3 additional pairs anywhere in the state for 3 consecutive years. Another way to get this delisting is having those 4 breeding pairs and then 6 additional anywhere in the state within a single year. So again, it's just a matter of how many additional pairs we have in different time windows. And then there's those less rigorous criteria for downlisting to state threatened or state sensitive. So for the threatened, it is 2 breeding pairs per region for 3 consecutive years. And for sensitive, it will be 4 breeding pairs per region for those 3 consecutive years. So there we have it. Our project timeline. This was the original slide that I presented back in July. So I haven't changed this at all. So June to September was our project scoping and our data compilation. And then right now we're in that phase of model development. And then moving into in February, March, that scenario development and implementation. And then come April is the big deadline for the draft report. And then it will be in revision with folks at WDFW. And then August is the submission of the final report and model code. So where are we? So we are here. And the reason I have both of those highlighted is that we're still on track. Absolutely. The first 2 stages are kind of happening both at once because we're kind of acquiring new data sources as we go. However, the model development isn't being held up right now because we can use simulated data to keep that model development going as we acquire and process some of these new data sources. So a reminder of our statistical approach, and again, I've kept this pretty broad. We are still using what we call an integrated population model. And this figure, as corny as it is, really does do a good job of showing that these different cogs in the wheel are all informing the model and doing so in a single model framework. So again, we're using these multiple data sets, and these are data sets informing survival, their population counts, their recruitment in a single model framework. And by doing this, in the past, you would kind of analyze survival by itself, you would analyze pack counts by itself, and then the breeding process by itself. But what you can do these days, because models are getting really fancy and fun, is that you can combine them in a single analysis, and you actually get better estimates. You get more precision, and it's just a more efficient use of data. And we are adding a spatial component here, which is important, you know, in bringing in that dispersal behavior and that colonization process. And this may be getting a bit too nerdy here, but we are using a Bayesian framework, which is just a statistical framework that allows for uncertainty to be propagated well. And also it's really flexible in getting some of the uncertainty built into the model. It's just a really flexible way of building these more complicated things. So the demographic model components. So the three big ones are the top level, the birth process, the abundance, and the survival. Within the integrated framework, the immigration and emigration, they're estimated, but not, they don't need to be directly observed for this model to work. And hence, that's why I'm using the dashed line. And also, we will be building in that colonization process as well at the pack level. So let's start with survival here. So for survival, we will be using GPS collar data from our 76 wolves. And essentially, we know that we have a lot of wolves leaving the state. And like these wolves are what we called censored. So they're essentially removed from the analysis when they leave the state, just so that we can keep our survival estimates to those wolves within the state. So our results so far, let me explain this to you before you start looking too deeply into it. So on the left, we have points from wolves that are inside the state. And on the right, these are points from wolves outside. Now that might be confusing. I just said when wolves left, they were removed. And that was true for wolves that left permanently. So wolves that were clearly on their way out doing big dispersal events and never came back, those were removed. However, don't forget there are those border pack wolves where they have some points inside, some points outside. And so we thought it'd be interesting to see, you know, for those wolves that share points inside and outside, how does being outside affect their survival? And then in the red here, we have the females, blue, we have the males. And then along the x-axis, we have our four age classes. We did have 9-month-old pups and beyond, and those were in the yearling class. And then we have the 2-year class, 3-year and adult. And this is annual survival. So now that I've explained the overall framework, in general, survival was lower with males. So in the blue, slightly lower than females, and for the dispersing age class. So that 2-year age class does tend to have lower annual survival. What I found really interesting is that for those wolves that were in border packs, presence outside of the state really reduces survival, particularly for those 2-year-old dispersers. So yeah, this is what we have so far for survival. And I'm happy to talk about that at the end if you're curious. And then moving on to the birth process. In this model. So we do have two data sources we're interested in, pup counts up to 2014. And we have 200,000 images and videos from WDFW camera traps. And thank you to Ben and his colleagues for pulling these together. It was took up just like a huge hard drive, and it was shipped to me in a timely fashion. And it's really great to have these data. So again, thank you, Ben and team. So these reproductive data still need a lot of processing. We're not exactly sure what we'll find at the end of it, but we are currently working through those data now. So I've organized these images and videos by pack and year, and they're ready for analysis. And we have made some inroads in hiring an undergrad to process these data using a program called TimeLapse. So TimeLapse is a program where you can easily tag photos and images and videos. You can do multiple at once, and it's just a great way of taking literally hundreds of thousands of data points and essentially creating just a spreadsheet of, okay, were there wolf pups seen or not? So we are interested pretty much only in the number of wolf pups that we're seeing in these images. And again, we'll see what we find. And then moving on to the abundance part, and again, this is the last of our three big parts for the demographic model. We'll be using data from winter aerial surveys by WDFW. And we have those surveys dating back to 2008 when wolves first entered the state. So I don't know if you all saw How to Count a Wolf, which is a short film that was produced using a lot of footage from WDFW's field surveys. And yeah, these are the type of data that we'll be using to inform that wolf abundance model. And they are aerial counts from fixed wing aircraft and helicopter. And it was such a great video for me to see. I'm still located in Syracuse, New York. And so to be able to see the incredibly fascinating, but also dangerous and hard work that these people are doing, it was really illuminating and made me realize how hard it is to count wolves. It's not as straightforward as one may think. So bringing it all together spatially, this is a bit blurry when I brought it into Google Slides, but I made this animation just to show you all. So like every color, yep, that wolf just did a dispersal event. Oh, there's another one. I thought it was just so cool to see how these wolves are moving and how important it is to bring in that spatial component. And I'll let this run just because I think it's cool. We're now in 2016. See, that one made it into Montana. That one, whoa, yeah. Sorry, I've seen this so many times and I still think it's incredibly cool. I think we have data through January of 2020, this one, yeah. So again, that's just showing the importance of how that spatial component is so important because so many of these models I'm talking about are non-spatial. And that won't fly for us here. So our current strategy is to create hypothetical pack territories across Washington and then have them colonize based on both habitat suitability and individual-based movements. So if that's confusing, let's say we have a wolf that is dispersing and there's a certain probability of that happening. If this wolf winds up in a hypothetical new pack that is good habitat, and then by chance another wolf disperses to that exact same hypothetical territory, then we have a new pack. And then we have to account for the fact that this process is much less likely to occur where there are no wolves. We've found that areas that consistently have wolves will have more wolves, and then for whatever reason, we're not seeing these movements into areas where there aren't wolves. So building in that difference in movement is also important. It's important here in the development of these hypothetical pack territories to know what size to make them. And we're determining that through our GPS collar data. So again, this is a fun little animation I made. I built these home ranges at the individual level using a technique called Brownian bridge. And we can see just how these home ranges pop up and disappear and just that dynamic nature through time. So that is how we determined the average pack size and the variation around that size. By pack size, I mean pack territory size, sorry. And then so that's how we build the size of those hypothetical territories. And then as to what determines habitat suitability, this is where we're looking into these new data. We're looking into systematically placed camera traps across Washington. Sarah Bassing, who's a PhD candidate at UW, who you may know already, she has graciously offered us her data for wolves within her sites at the Washington Predator Prey Project. We're speaking with Robert Wong at Woodland Park Zoo, Dan Thornton at Washington State, and Jason Ransom at the National Park Service. So again, we're just reaching out to these people. All of them have responded positively and they want to help. So this can be a really great data source in terms of helping us figure out basically what is suitable habitat for wolves in Washington. Here are some covariates that I predicted, that we predicted would affect habitat suitability for wolves. Starting at the top there, we have all deer species, and that's a relative abundance based on harvest data from WDFW. Similar for moose, it's harvest data, relative abundance stuff. And then we have our individual deer species, the white-tailed, the black-tailed, and the mule deer. But again, those were all encapsulated in the all deer covariate. We have percent canopy, we have human population density, we have terrain ruggedness, we have distance to state highway in the bottom left there. And I have to add elevation still. So again, for those wild ungulates, deer and moose, we are using harvest data as a proxy for relative abundance. For elk, because you may be wondering about elk, things change a little bit. So WDFW ungulate folks told us that elk harvest data in the state do not track with relative abundance. They said that their quotas were set to maintain certain cow-calf ratios rather than abundance of elk themselves. So they suggested we go with these annual herd estimates, which are carried out by WDFW. And then I started digging into the data and I found that there are very different survey strategies by herd. Sometimes the whole herd is surveyed, sometimes just certain GMUs within the herd, other times the single site within a herd. And for some herds, there are no estimates available because aerial surveys are too difficult because of cloud cover, not cloud, sorry, because of canopy, just dense timber, essentially. So it's difficult to standardize across all these different approaches. So what we may have to do in the end is go with a 1 if it's an elk herd area and a 0 if it's not, just because I'm finding it a little difficult to try to create an overall picture. We're also getting data on public grazing allotments from a number of sources and focusing on those with cattle in particular. I know Ben has said there are some that are just sheep. We know that the cattle allotments range, they rotate from year to year and the numbers change. And we're finding it's almost impossible to get the numbers of cattle in those allotments within the time frame that we need it by. So again, my first report is due in April. And I know that one former PhD student at WSU, it took her 2 years to get data on within the allotments. So we, again, may have to rely on just a 1-0, is it an allotment or not an allotment, to bring in that cattle component. Not a perfect solution, but I just don't think we have the time to track down those numbers. Okay, so coming into the final stretch here, going back to the beginning of this spatial model. So here are these hypothetical pack tories that I've modeled across the state, and the size and variation of these packs were based on the GPS collar data. And I know the sound is looking crazy. I need to go back and use a simpler polygon. And then here I subset the state just to the northeast to work with a smaller area. And these are certain relationships that I predicted for wolf occurrence based on simulated data and certain covariates. So in reality, we'll be using the data from the systematically placed camera traps to inform these relationships. But for now, I simulated data, I predicted these relationships, and I found that wolf occurrence will be higher away from highways, where there's less people, where there's canopy cover, and where there are deer. And then, yeah, here is that modeled probability of occurrence. So yellow is where, yeah, like wolves are likely to be there, and that blue color is where they are unlikely to be. And then the white are, again, those hypothetical packs placed over it. And let's look at that pack. I don't know if my cursor will show up, but like this one in the bottom left there. So given the predicted probability of occurrence here for wolves, which is really low, It's probably unlikely that two wolves would find themselves there and go on to establish a pack. It's just not likely. However, it is more likely for these other hypothetical packs that may not already have a pack established. So let's say, again, I'm not sure if my cursor is working, but let's say there's a pack here. Given a dispersal perhaps to this one, just one, if you can't see my cursor, one that's more yellow, then there's probably a higher probability of that colonization process happening. So again, that dispersal process represents our biggest challenge. So we really need to do a deep dive into the literature to find out what these dispersal distances tend to be, under what circumstances those big dispersals occur. So we're still working on that. And yeah, so the colonization of the South Cascades and the peninsula, you know, it's a big challenge. We don't have direct data to inform this. We don't have GPS collar data from wolves moving through these really unsuitable areas, you know, crossing I-90, colonizing an area that doesn't currently have wolves. So yeah, we're still deciding how to approach that, and we may need to consider a few different scenarios. So what we're still figuring out, again, is that recruitment side. Can those 200,000 images and videos help us? We hope so, but maybe not. Again, that spatial side, incorporating movement, dispersal, and that's what we're currently making progress on. And then those future scenarios. And again, that's something I think for February, March. So we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. As for our results, we want that model capturing both the present population dynamics and space use of wolves while considering uncertainty. The photo here, I think, is for, yeah, the piping plover, the Great Lakes piping plover. And I'm sure we'll get confidence that's just as tight as in that figure. And for future time points, probability of meeting the downlisting and delisting criteria, getting those predicted abundance and distribution for the future, and probability of extinction. And yeah, that expected time to meet the different criteria. And of course, uncertainty, because measuring that uncertainty is important because there is so much that we don't know. And so yeah, that uncertainty will play a big part in our modeling. And so management judgment will be needed. This is my final slide. And this is where you all will come in. Again, you're the ones coexisting with wolves and working landscapes. And so your input will be really important here. So are the criteria still appropriate given predicted probability of extinction and expected future abundance? Do those criteria have to be adjusted? Are the management scenarios that we've come up with, are they realistic? And if not, how can we make them realistic? And again, any assumptions that are being made in this modeling exercise, are they supported? And if they're not supported, how can we change what we're doing? And so again, that was a brief overview into our model. And thanks again to you all for your attention and to my collaborators for being such great partners in all of this. So we welcome your questions. I can stop sharing my screen as well. And yeah, we'll take your questions.
Thanks, Lee Van. Another great presentation. We really appreciate it. So questions, committee members.
I have a question, Kim.
Okay, Barbara. Yes.
I kind of have two questions. I was interested, so I think we're all very interested in dispersal and how we can help that happen, or maybe eradicate whatever's blocking it from happening. Lisanne, you noted that the worst mortalities were for the 2-year-olds who go outside, come in and out of the state. And what I wondered is, are you tracking that by where they go and what's killing them, or is it just, we just know that?
Yeah, so there are definitely ways of determining what exactly is killing wolves in this case, the second they leave the state permanently, they're out of my, our right. analysis. But there are ways of figuring that out. But for now, if they're gone, gone, we're not interested. So we've only left in those border pack wolves in our calculation of survival. And we're seeing that even with those border pack wolves, the second they cross state lines, their survival really drops.
And so I guess my real question is, does it matter which way they go? If they go north to Canada or if they go east to Montana or south to Oregon, are you tracking that or it just is, or it's just, you're just lumping them all together?
Ben could probably speak to that better than I could. For now, yeah, if they're out, they're out. I'm not tracking which direction they're going. Ben, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, we do. We keep a log of the wolves. If we get the caller back or we get a call that wolf's been harvested out of state, we tend to keep track. In Idaho and Montana and BC, they don't tend to live very long. A lot of times they get trapped or hunted in those jurisdictions. In Oregon, you know, they tend to make it a little bit longer. So yeah, but there's just the open hunting seasons in all those jurisdictions where there's a hunting and trapping season, their life expectancy just isn't that long.
Okay, thanks, Ben. That's good to know. Kim, may I ask one more question?
Go ahead.
So that slide that you had with the yellow hypothetical pack, yellow and blue, and all the little shaped places on there. My question, you don't have to put it back up.
Okay. I was going to, but I won't.
Are you looking at an overlay of where we have packs now and sort of assuming that if the yellow's the prime territory and it's empty, that might be the way that a pack, a brave young wolf might disperse? Is that kind of the idea of that?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Again, we're still talking about the spatial model and if we're going about things the right way. But my impression is that we would assign existing packs to the nearest hypothetical pack territory on that landscape. So we would have the present scenario integrated within those hypothetical pack territories.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thank you, Kim.
Thanks, Barbara. Others? Jim, Molly.
This is Jim. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Not sure how well formulated this question is, but with the dispersals, you got an idea of animals that leave. Is there a way to track those animals that leave, say, as 2-year-olds, but may come back as 3 or 4 or 5? Is there any, is there any kind of ability to kind of get that analysis? Does that make any sense? So not only wolves that leaves, but wolves that leave and return?
I don't think we've had any wolves necessarily. We've had a couple that are right on the border that have, when they're kind of hit that year and a half, 2 year old, they might do a trial run where they'll leave their natal pack and they'll go for 2 weeks and then they'll come back to their natal pack. But once they kind of go and take off, and if they're gone more than a couple of weeks, they generally won't come back. They're going to beeline somewhere and start a new pack territory somewhere hundreds of miles away, usually.
They're dispersed and that's forever, more or less. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
I have a question, Kim.
Yes, go ahead, Molly.
So my curiosity is around, I totally understand the conundrum of getting grazing numbers. And so we're talking about applying either a 1 or a 0 to grazing allotments. And I'm wondering if the data, I sense that this is going to obviously be an area of particular interest to a lot of people. either way. And so I'm wondering if you have enough data or a way to sort of tease out if grazing is impacting wolves, given that tough, you know, getting actual numbers. Is there a way to be, I don't want to say give it more weight because that sounds like you're just willy-nilly changing. I guess I'm just wondering if there's a way to sort of, you know, tease that data set out a little bit more thoroughly.
Yeah, so all we have now is the shape file, essentially just like the spatial extent of what is an allotment and what is not an allotment. And then we have some data on, you know, the ranger station it's associated with. But in terms of more nuance on that, at the moment, I'm not really sure what else we could do with that.
So Lisanne, maybe I'll just add, just in terms of a distinction, one of the things that what Lisanne talked about and what she's trying to do is understand where wolves tend to live as a function of these kinds of things, everything from cattle and deer to elevation and terrain ruggedness. So do they tend to want to live in those places rather than is their survival linked to living in those places? That analysis isn't something that we've tried to do, largely probably because it would be hard to translate, well, to a statewide level, what that would actually mean in terms of predicting the future. We could do that once we get to the sort of future scenarios. I think we could ask some of those kinds of questions, but it's hard at this point, and especially, right, most of the wolves that we've observed so far do tend to live in areas that are relatively close to cattle allotments. And when you don't have any contrast in the data, it's harder to understand relationships, basically. So we're really looking at it in terms of how likely does it make it for you to live there rather than does it affect your survival. And those two can be independent, right? You can have something that attracts wolves in, but also results in lower survival. In fact, a well-understood sort of ecological phenomenon. They're sort of separate relationships.
Thanks, that's helpful. So I see Donnie and Julia's hands up. I have a few questions. They're not related to this. I'm wondering if Donnie and Julia, if you have questions or comments related to Molly's point in the responses.
I do. Just a real quick one. Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. On the issue of the stocking rates for the allotments, I think we ought to be actually contacting the Forest Service or the BLM on that. We're not the authorities for stocking rates, and so that might be just connecting you, Lisanne, to Robert Garcia is up to speed on wolf stuff. He's a part of our WAG, and maybe we can connect you to the right entity there. Whether that gets you them or not, and you have to go with ones and zeros, maybe that's still where you land, but we're not the authorities for what the stocking rates are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I knew that, and so Ben gave me some great contacts. How it had been described to me, it seemed that we may need to reach out to each forest district individually and do a FOIA and getting those numbers. And yeah, given that I've been told it just took a really long time, we're still talking about whether or not it's worth, you know, going that extra mile and getting those data. That's a great suggestion though. More contacts is always a good thing. So
you bet. Well, I'll get a hold of Robert right away and see if he's able to help or not.
Awesome. Thank you.
There's also, sorry, just to add, there's change in that over time as well, which obviously complicates it as well, given that, again, we're trying to use this to model the basically how likely is it that wolves would live in a place. So, And there's also a difference between the realized stocking rate versus the approved stocking rate.
Molly?
I Sarah already really said it. I was just going to say, you know, if you use the AUMs for each grazing allotment, that would at least get you a little bit more fine tune. I think those are pretty available publicly. But again, that doesn't actually give you the actual stocking rate. So that's not super helpful, but it just seems like there's so teasing out the noise of around grazing is, I can see the challenge of that. So, yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Molly. I see Vin's hand up. I'll just make a comment. You know, what we have asked for is a population model and individual wolf survival, which is kind of what this is around, doesn't contribute a whole lot. It's overall mortality that contributes to population size and sustenance. So I think we need to keep that in mind as we go forward. Ben, I saw your hand up.
Thanks, Commissioner. I just was going to add too that the grazing allotments are a seasonal thing as well. And so the area's got to be able to support wolves year round and have a natural prey source and everything else. And so, you know, the allotments, although that may be a contributing factor of wolves in that area, it's probably more or less the local prey populations that are going to bring those animals into those areas. So like you were saying, this is a population. We want to know where wolves are going to establish on the landscape and where the highest probability of them to recolonize is. And so having a model that helps identify those is probably the most critical for our needs there for right now.
Thanks, Ben. Julia.
Thank you. This question is not related to the grazing allotments, if that's okay. Okay. It might be a Ben question as well. I have two questions. I'm wondering if it seems like we have a good handle on emigration and looking at wolves that leave the state and kind of having an understanding of their fates. Do we have, either through genetics or through collar data, a good understanding of immigration into the state and fate of those wolves? And then the second question is a Lisanne question, which is the other side of dispersal, you know, and understanding the ability of wolves to colonize the third recovery region that they haven't got to yet. I'm wondering about not only dispersal capability on the wolf's part, but landscape permeability and whether there's thought to evaluate something like a least cost path, something like that. And, or maybe it's the same thing, but if your modeling will provide an idea of landscape permeability.
Ben, do you want to take the immigration question?
Sure. Yeah, so right now we do have a project going with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in a good chunk of the western states where we're working with Petco's lab, and we've submitted a number of samples from packs all around the state that are going to look at genetic relatedness. We don't have the results from that analysis back yet, but Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, the primary western states have all pulled together with DNA samples, and we're looking at that kind of broader look. We just don't have that back yet. So we don't necessarily have a lot of great understanding when we submit our DNA results. We can see who's related to who within the state, but we don't necessarily get who's related to who out of the state. We just don't have that sample. So hopefully this newer analysis will help shed some light on that situation. But immigration is always tough. I will say, you know, the hunting seasons in Idaho and Montana and BC are pretty effective at removing wolves. And so I suspect the immigration rate is probably less than what we produce in the state right now, just because our wolves are a little more protected in Washington and Oregon.
Yeah, as for your question about landscape permeability, which is a really, really good one, that's something that we're still, this is where the momentum where we're at right now is talking about these things and trying to work through them. Because again, I-90 needs to be considered on the landscape as it is unlikely for a wolf to cross this. And So how to build that in is clearly incredibly important in that colonization process and something that we're still thinking through. I don't know if Sarah, Beth have anything to add there, but something that obviously needs to be integrated for sure.
Yeah, I'd say there's three things that are challenging. One, where's wolf food? We've talked about that, right? Deer and cows and other wild ungulates, basically. How are wolves going to make it into this new area that they haven't made it into yet? Obviously that's challenging because, we just don't have any observations of what's ultimately a really rare process, right? So wolves moving into areas where there's already wolves established, that's something that we see all the time. Wolves moving into areas where there aren't wolves established is hard. So it's very hard to bring the existing data to bear on that. And then the third thing I would say is the reproductive component. So where is the stuff that wolves tend to eat? How are they going to move around, especially to the Southwest? And what's going on with reproduction are the three biggest challenges that we have. Yeah.
This was one of the question comments that I was going to make, and I've been kind of holding back, but I'm going to make it right now. There's been a lot of work with a number of peony species, Western range wide, I think WAFWA is kind of spearheading it at this point, on connectivity for various species. And as the models have been developed, they look at both, the sort of benefits of a landscape that allow the transit, but really focus on barriers. And I was noting that what I see in the modeling that you're doing at this point, or the thinking, the barriers are the population and the roads. I'm wondering if it might be worth it to look at some of that connectivity work that's gone on for various species to get some other ideas about other possible barriers, and because it basically is the same kind of work that's gone on for a number of species, and I was struck. I clearly roads and population are going to be huge barriers to dispersal, but in Washington particularly, I think it may this tiny little state that's full of people is unique in terms of wolf population and dispersal. But looking at other work that's gone on for T&E species in this state might lend some other ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point.
Okay, I see Donnie's hand up.
Yeah, Commissioner Thorburn, I just wanted to tie it back to the comment you made just before what you said, and that's about, so how does it relate to our current population? And so this is also for our publics listening in. So as Lisanne was going through her presentation, the same thing was in my head until she got to her last couple slides, and she did a great job of tying it all together. So in my experience working with Ben, with his iterations of this before, I think that our team here at UW and Ben they're working on the survival, the mortality factors, all the demographics that's kind of behind the curtain and the habitat layer and all that kind of stuff. And then it's not only kind of where the current population is, but what's the trajectory, right? Where's it going? Where we'll be able to kind of answer that. They'll be able to help us answer that question about, where's our current population at? And is it ultimately that decision for the commission? Does it warrant a change in listing status? And so, Lisanne, nice job. I think you tied it all together very well as you were kind of going through where we're at. But for our publics also, it's those building blocks that will let us kind of, that are behind the curtain, so to speak, that we'll be able to answer this question when we get to that point of this process.
Thanks, Donnie. That's a good wrap up. I have a couple of more, I think, fairly quick questions. Based on early on slides, just trying to understand how that data is being pulled together. So you talked about the wolves that move in and out of Washington. Does that include wolves that move within Washington but in and out of sovereign areas, as in Colville and Spokane reservations and hunting areas? Because, you know, are we censoring those wolves that colonize into those areas?
Yeah, that's a great point. As we have it now, given that our base of inference is Washington State, we were pretty hard on the border being out of state and being within. But that's a great point that I actually hadn't thought of.
Yeah, I might be worth thinking about. And then my second one, you talked about home range on one of your slides and then kind of switched to packs. When I think home range, I usually think about it being developed for an individual animal based usually on collar data or whatever. So what does home range mean with a pack? Can you explain how that's linked together?
Yeah. You are asking a very timely question, Commissioner, because, so that work I did just to keep things standardized. I did it at the individual level, knowing that ultimately this will be at the pack level. The thing is that, and this is what I'm doing and I was working on today and will be doing tomorrow, is as the number of collared animals in a pack increases, how does that estimation of a, you know, home range or a pack territory, how does that change? And so, yeah, for the moment, and it's subject to change, it is still individual. But of course, if we're looking at a pack, we will have to see, you know, when you have two individuals and here is their territory size, and then how does that change when you have three collared in a pack or only one? And what are the assumptions that we have to make in moving to that pack level? So we're still there and we will be scaling that up, but that's a great, that was a great point.
Thank you. Okay, Ben, I see your hand up. Great.
And just also to bring up and follow up on that point, you know, the wolf pack is kind of a cohesive family unit, and it does depend on which animal is collared. If it's just a, you know, subadult or might be a pup of the year versus a breeding animal in that pack. The breeding male at different times of the year might be considerably different than the breeding female if she's tied to a den. And so that there's things that are going to contribute to that pack territory size. But over an annual basis, you can generally, getting a collar in that pack is going to give you the general territory boundary of that pack. And so it'll be good to look at that with multiple animals in the pack, but I wouldn't expect there to be a significant difference in the number of individuals versus that general territory boundary for the pack.
Yeah, that's a great point. And something I did notice is that, of course, there are some wolves that were collared for a very short period of time. And so I made sure to use a point number. I think it was 200 GPS locations. If you use any less than that, you start seeing a relationship with number of points and home range size. When you go beyond that 200, you start seeing stability there. So, yeah, we restricted those estimates to at least 200. And now it's a matter of seeing the differences between individuals and then pack level stuff.
Great. Thanks, Lisanne. Barbara, I see your hand up.
Well, I wanted to thank you, Kim, for asking the question about the tribes and the sovereign units east of the mountains. That is something that I believe it was Ben and I talked about quite a while ago, so I'm hazy on this. So this is the question, Ben. I think that what you told me as we were trying to figure out just basically why wolves weren't dispersing west and south is that, you know, there are other pieces of ground in there, and it, sometimes it's hard for them to get across. But what you did say, I believe, was that there was that you guys are very closely connected with the biologists from those tribes and staying in quite good touch about that. So since I'm interested in that, I wondered if number one, if my memory is accurate, and number two, if so, if perhaps you could come talk to us about, if there's anything that we need to understand about that, I'd like to know a lot more about it. So that's a question for Ben.
So we, each year when we do the annual report, and when we do capture work and collaring, I work with the biologists of both Spokane Tribe and the Colville Tribe, and hopefully as wolves get further south and west, we'll work with the other tribes as well, so we get more overlap. But we do share numbers, so we don't always share the collar data back and forth. If it's, they do the monitoring on the tribal lands and on the reservation, and we do the monitoring in the other areas that we manage, but we share the information on counts and numbers. Up until last year, the Colville Confederated Tribes had put a fair amount of resources. They've kind of looked at their area now as being recolonized and recovered, and so they allocated resources differently. We've still been working with the Spokane Tribe on numbers. The Huckleberry Pack overlaps their reservation. And so we do, they still do their own management and set their hunting seasons and the things that they're going to do. But, we definitely work with them on that. And so I guess, is there more specifically, did I get what you needed, Commissioner Baker?
Sure. For today, yes. I may have some more questions, but I'll let you know.
Okay.
And Ben, I want to say two of the wolves, I believe from Colville, are in our GPS data. Because I remember we couldn't age them, but they're there.
Yeah, so we do have some information that we've shared. We just don't have a complete data set there. Mm-hmm. So some are on reservation, some are off. And they have ceded lands that we both co-manage in certain areas too. And so it just depends on the jurisdiction and where they're at.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Well, again, Sarah and Lisanne and Beth, we really appreciate your time, and Lisanne, again, great presentation. You really do a good job presenting really complicated material. I think we're going to be really interested in your next steps, setting up those scenarios. So if we can look forward to early into that period, having an opportunity to meet with you again, that would be great. Donnie will continue to be our liaison to kind of set up the meetings. But if we can look at that early springtime sometime as you're really beginning to move into that, I think the committee will be very interested in that next step. So anything else? Well, I think that concludes the stated portion of the agenda then. We do have a couple of other update kinds of items. So I think, Donnie, do you want to go ahead and?
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Commissioner. So I have a couple other updates. The first one I'll tackle here is kind of what the WAG has been up to. And I just wanted to thank you, committee members. You've been, I see as we've had the various WAG meetings, at least one or more of you are engaged in that process, whether you're as a panelist or an attendee. And so I just wanted to say thank you for that. I think that's an important step. So WAG has been working on what we started calling the last few meetings, the chronic conflict zones. They're now using a slightly different term, the special focus areas. And we can describe that more later. But so one of the steps that the department would like to do, and I shared with WAG members, is to make sure that we are getting the voice. We're crosswalking this process between the WAG, the commission, and the governor's office. And that means before there is a
recommendation from WAG to the director. They're an advisory group to the director. So earlier in the process, when the sausage is being made, you have an opportunity to look at it, and possibly if you're in a position to be able to share perspectives and, you know, that sort of thing. And so we'll do that. We'll also do that with the governor's office. You know, the interest the governor's office has in this. So we're at a point now where we have a very, very draft document. And when I say draft, I mean that we're not at a spot where WAG has complete cohesion on this issue. And in the draft, it's called Section 9. It's the special focus areas or the chronic conflict zones. So it is packaged as Section 9. It may look different by the time, if they do reach cohesion on it, it may look very different than it is now. So it's an early version. Again, so early in the process, you have a chance to take a look at it and provide perspectives. And so we're going to be getting that to you probably by the first of next week, and also to the governor's office for you guys to be able to take a look at and get any comments back or bring those comments to the next WAG meeting in January. I'll make sure that you all have that. One other item related to that, at the last WAG meeting we had, we had a very heartfelt discussion about Section 9 and the purpose of Section 9. Do we need Section 9? And in that, my emotions got the best of me. And I made some comments about how important Section 9 is, how important the department thinks it is. And I overstated some things. So I want to correct that statement that I made. I made a statement that everybody wants this. And obviously that's not true. I can't speak for everybody. And I made a statement that the commission wants this. And I want to state here on the record that the commission has not taken a position statement on that. So that was captured in the media. And I just wanted to come back to that and correct a misstatement that I made. So any before I go on to my next agenda item, any comments or questions from anybody on the WAG process and that Section 9 chronic conflict zones?
Yes, Molly.
This is definitely not your responsibility, Donnie, but I am finding, you know, as drinking from the fire hose of commission, sometimes I just miss the WAG meetings, time-wise. If it's not your responsibility, I want to be really clear, but if you thought to give me a heads up, just a quick email or a text or something a day or so before, that would be awesome. But I'm trying to get them on my calendar. I hate when I look at up and I realize I've missed one because I do want to participate. But again, not your responsibility, but if you think to do it, that would be super helpful.
Absolutely, Commissioner Linville, we will. And the last one is an impromptu one, so I think it probably was on our shoulders. But we will absolutely make sure that you are all aware, and we'll give a reminder a couple of days beforehand as well.
That would be awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I would echo that. This is Jim Anderson. It's, you know, it'd be nice to get those ahead of time on the calendar for me.
You bet. Will do.
Anybody else? Thanks, Donnie, for the summary. And in terms of, let me just say, as member of the commission, we're really glad that WAG is taking this on and following it along. And WAG, this is WAG's area of specialty to deal with this kind of conflict. And so we're sort of waiting to hear from WAG. We do have no position on it at this point. Thank you.
You bet.
Okay. I think that takes care of that issue. I don't see any more hands. Unless Molly is your... Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Donnie.
Okay, my next one is I wanted to give you an update on the rulemaking process from the directive from the governor's office. So we have done a lot of homework on this issue in terms of what needs to be... what's part of the process, what's the steps of the process. So it's a little more complicated than the rulemaking that I've been used to and earlier parts of my career. So there's three steps that we think are necessary for this rulemaking process. And I'm going to quickly kind of walk through those just to kind of highlight the topics. One of those is going to be SEPA around the current plan or the process. So it could be a supplemental SEPA around the current plan or a standalone SEPA process that's associated with this rulemaking. The second is, and we talked about this briefly before, the small business economic impact statement associated with this process. And so we've met with an advisor, the governor's office that works specifically on that. Sorry, and understand what entails into that. I'm going to take a quick sip here. And understand kind of what goes into that. Now, the small business economic impact statement is one that can't start until a draft rule has been developed. And so it is, here are the envisioned economic impacts of this draft rule. So that process can't even take shape until we have a draft rule to look at. So that other part obviously is creating the draft rule. So with those three components and knowing we can't start the small business economic impact statement until after a draft rule is created, one of the things that was in the governor's letter is a desire to have this by the start of the 2021 grazing season. And we don't believe that's realistic with these components, SEPA, rule development, and then the supplemental environmental or economic impact statement. We just don't see that happening. So I wanted to share that with all of you. I've had that conversation with Director Suswin, had that conversation with the commission chair and with Commissioner Baker. I wanted to share that with the Wolf Committee. My next stop is to share that with the governor's office to make sure they're aware of that. And we're already going to be starting this process, but it's going to have those three legs to it. But I wanted to make sure that you were aware of kind of what we envision how long that will take. I'll pause if there's any questions.
Yes, Jim.
Yeah, just quick. You mentioned the SEPA on the current plan, but you mean that it's a SEPA on the rule?
It could be a standalone SEPA for the rule, or it could also be a supplemental for the plan, because we operate within the guidance of the plan or the bookends of the plan. So my example would be, Commissioner Anderson, is there has been published science around non-lethal and lethal since the plan was adopted. Okay. And we would tuck that more recent science into that SEPA process would be to do a supplemental on the plan. So that would be an example of, you know, a SEPA process associated with a rule development.
Was there an EIS on that plan in 2011 or 2012? Okay.
There was. Okay.
So that's remains to be seen. Is that whether it will be on the rule or on the plan? How is that decision going to be made?
You know, we're working with the Attorney General's office on that. At this stage, I suspect that the SEPA process is around the plan. To update and the SEPA that was associated with the 2011 plan.
Okay.
And I think that Commissioner Thorburn and I spoke about this earlier. I think that there may be an opportunity for you all to visit with counsel on that to understand those that situation, any potential legal risks.
Anybody else? Donnie, I think you're off the hook. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Commissioner. Yes. So please, by early next week, check your inbox. You'll be getting that draft section 9. And in that will be the kind of, you know, looking for opportunities for you to get feedback to us.
Thanks. Anybody else on Wolf Matters? Julia, do you have anything, I put you on the hook, that you want to say to the committee on your area of work?
Sure, yeah. So the last time that we spoke, I think I told you I gave you an update on where we were with looking at that brainstorming document and putting together a framework for developing alternatives for the post-recovery plan. And that has since gone through many levels of the agency, the Wolf Internal Group, senior staff, executive management team. And so as promised, that first went out to the tribes. And so that is still where it is. It's with the tribes. And then our next step will be, I'm in the process of organizing an interagency Wolf Committee meeting. That's the group that involves the federal agencies, land management agencies, other people who can serve and manage wolves. So I will have that meeting scheduled. Once the doodle poll closes this week, I'll schedule that. And, so that'll be the next step there. I think that a concurrent step, if you commissioners are ready for that and it fits with your agenda, should be to go ahead and present it with you all and see what, if you're ready to dive into it at that stage, that same time that it goes to the Wolf Committee. As for the Wolf Advisory Group, I don't know when they'll be ready to tackle that information, and I will follow their lead, and when they are ready for it, they can have that conversation. Otherwise, we'll have to just keep moving forward with all of our other groups who we work with. Oh, and any questions that you have, I'm happy to address.
Well, I don't see any hands. I sort of heads up to committee members. We've had a chance to kind of get a preliminary. So probably a meeting that we need to schedule early next year to kind of give our input on it. So, Barbara.
Well, thanks, Kim. That's what I was going to say. When I remember when we talked about this before, we were going to get this document shortly after the tribes did, but we do understand that since we're open, that we needed to give them a chance to review it before we see it. That said, I'd like to see it as soon as possible. If we could just leave it there and have a meeting and do it the correct way. I wanted to go back to Donnie's question or Donnie's presentation for a minute because I got confused. Just to be clear, what I thought that we have done in our last couple of meetings, Donnie, is decide as a committee that no matter how hard we try, we cannot keep with the governor's timeline of actually promulgating rules in advance of next year's grazing season. So we talked about having WAG go ahead with what they're working on and getting it to us. I like the idea that it's also going to the governor, and hopefully we can incorporate that into what we do. But we're still going to have those. We're still going to work on promulgating the governor's rules as soon as we can. I think that's what you said, and I just wanted to verify that. But then I got confused on the SEPA. Isn't the SEPA analysis that we are going to need to do, as well as the small business impact statement, isn't that to the new rules that we draft? I got confused when you were talking about the 2011 plan, and I may have just misheard you.
Yeah, Commissioner Baker, and I think we're quickly already out of my expertise here. So I think it would be good to have this question posed to Joe Panesco and Amy Dona and others at the AG's office. My understanding is, you know, speaking with the AG's office is that I think it's to our benefit in the rulemaking process to make sure we're being inclusive of some items in the SEPA world, that it's had the right SEPA process associated with that. I think that's going to be a supplemental of the plan that will still cover you in the rulemaking, you know, because that's my understanding. I have not experienced it where we do SEPA on a rule. You may have done that in the past, and I'm not familiar with that. But the conversations we've had so far with the Attorney General's office is this would be a supplemental SEPA on the plan EIS to tuck in some things that have occurred or some strengthen that process for your eventual rulemaking. Commissioner Baker, this is where you have experience beyond what I do, and I can see the wheels turning in your head. And so I'm just probably don't have what you're looking for in terms of that response, but we'll get it to you.
Joe, then, I see you, your
You did prompt me for one other thing, though, Commissioner Baker, when you said that. So thank you. Now, that was an express. So the governor's process is to, from a legal perspective, and again, I'm outside of my wheelhouse, so Joe's here to help out if I step too far out, is that he was able to say, commission, conduct rulemaking. That's the legal process that the governor has. The governor then added some desires, if you will, in the letter that was sent. And one of those was the timeline. And I think what you've nailed it, Commissioner Baker, what we're sharing here is we don't see this happening by the beginning of the 2021 grazing season. So maybe there's other things the commission could do prior to the 2021 grazing season. Maybe there's you would all like to make a policy statement or something like that. That's still within your reach. If there's something else you would like to do, that's not rulemaking or just a stated public direction for the agency, please focus on this and keep working with the WAG or et cetera. But I wanted to bring that part up where there may be other things that you want to do, recognizing that this is going to take a little longer for the rulemaking process.
I would just emphasize that WAG has been working on this for a while and we're kind of waiting for their work. So Joe, I see your mic off. Do you want to say anything?
Yes. So Donnie nailed it in terms of the deadline stated in the governor's letter is just a suggested goal. It is not a legally binding deadline. And doing this right and legally defensible is the controlling factor. And the analyses that the agency must conduct to make it legally defensible takes time. So that's the reality of this is the small business economic impact statement, if one is triggered by this, the SEPA analysis, those should be done right, and it takes time to do it so that we can legally defend those against a challenge on a topic that has been the subject of much litigation in the past, and thus, it's very likely a continued high litigation risk with this rulemaking effort. In terms of the SEPA action, we will continue. Our office will continue to provide legal advice to the department on its options. There is flexibility in how to incorporate prior documentation or analysis of environmental impacts on an activity that ties in with the current proposal. So the EIS that was conducted on the Wolf Plan has some analysis that is certainly going to be relevant to the proposed rulemaking, and how that analysis factors into the new SEPA analysis. Again, there's flexibility. And we'll continue to provide legal advice to program staff as they go through the process and implement those steps. So I don't want to say that there's not a specifically set path about how to incorporate them. Is it a supplement? There's a lot of options there. And those final decisions will be made by the department once they go forward with their SEPA steps and notification to the public. So that's everything I have.
Anything else? Okay, I think we've satisfied everybody. I don't see any more hands. So that then brings us to the end of our business. And again, I really want to thank Lisanne and Sarah and Beth and Ben for being here for this presentation. Look forward to the next steps in a couple of months. So thanks, everybody. I will adjourn this meeting.
Thank you all.